This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. This episode is brought to you by Jam Software, makers of the Casper Suite device management system for Macs and iOS devices, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you?
Great, just got back from a minor league baseball game, oddly enough.
Win or lose?
When we left, they had the Chattanooga Lookouts, which is the AA team of the Los Angeles Dodgers, was winning 5-2, but also had a no-hitter going. So okay. Don't ask how that happens. Much errors. So we had to leave. What it is we always auction things off, and the headmaster and I always auction off that, you know, parent can bid on their kid, and three of their friends can go with us to the Lookouts game in the middle of the day. You know, we'll have pizza and stuff. So. Mm-hmm. It's a real hard day for me. Real hard day.
Yeah, sometimes you get days like that in education, don't you?
Yes.
Can't believe I'm getting paid for this.
It makes up for yesterday when I had two switches installed and a new firewall installed. So that made up for that day because that was a long day.
Yeah, that's not ever going to be a day that you really enjoy, is it?
Well, thankfully everything went okay. And so it was, you know, our switching setup is very simple. The only thing that's on a VLAN is our phone system. And then the firewall was simple because since we're staying with the same company, it's you can export and import your settings.
Okay.
And so the only thing we really had to do was, you know, with things like our external statics that are pointed to, like, internally our camera systems and our HVACs, those kind of have to be re-pinged from the ISP. And so you kind of have to do that from the, you know, firewall. But other than that, it was pretty simple. That's the benefit of staying with the same vendor. I mean, it's... SonicWall is not perfect, but it does kind of work. It's interesting. The branding is now very much Dell. Our last one was a SonicWall, and this one is a Dell SonicWall. So they're black, and they've got the Dell logo on them. Still the NSA branding, but what are you going to do?
But now even more aggressive looking.
Is what you're yes, saying. Black.
more manly than ever before.
Yeah, when I built the DHCP scope, the guy, our vendor, was like, "Do you need that many?" I was like, I do need that many. That's why we're buying this one and not the cheaper one.
Yeah, you really need to go that fast in your Ferrari?
Yes.
Of course.
Yeah, I went and did a speed test, and it was actually, we got 400, you know, hardwired Ethernet, 450 megs down, and then like 425 megs up. Interesting, we're using his, like probably, two or three year old Dell laptop, the speed test at the core, and got like 100 by 100. And he said it was a gigabit port. But I was like, I bet that computer is not just able to push it. And so I went and tested an iMac. It flew. So I'll take 450 down.
Don't dare complain about that, I think.
No. Well, I mean, it's like anything. It's at some point, can you even tell? I mean, at some point, can your computer even load things fast enough?
Yeah, and is even the other end fast enough?
Well, no, certainly not. And, you know, where that would be really helpful, you know, I can imagine if I was, some sort of distributed learning organization where you have campuses around town, if you could link them all, like if you were having to link it kind of back to your home base and you had that kind of speed on the other end, that would certainly be handy because that would be, I mean, that would be near, it would be half of a gigabit speed across your WAN back to whatever server you're connecting to. But you're right. Does that even really affect me the other day? No, it doesn't. It's nice to brag about, but you can't even tell. I mean, my internet here is 4 times faster than mine at home, and I can't tell.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, it's all about loading it up with multiple users concurrently, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It gives you that headroom, I suppose. Cool. So I have been on holiday, which has been fantastic. Off last week, off this week, which is why we recorded last week's show a little bit early. I have been basically doing not very much, except playing with Lightroom Mobile, which was kind of in your wheelhouse, Bradley, as the internet's photo management expert. It's pretty cool. I've been really impressed with it. Have you had a look?
I have not. It's like on my list of things to download and try. I just have not gotten to it. I was anticipating the Dropbox announcement. I've been tinkering with the Carousel app a little bit, and then also a new cloud syncing company, or not new, but a new one for me, MediaFire. And they kind of got some buzz on Lifehacker when they lowered their price for a terabyte to $25 a year. So I was tinkering with that a little bit, And but I do need to try Lightroom Mobile as well.
Yeah, I mean, cloud storage competition is getting pretty brutal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, the thing I'm kind of wrestling with in my head, when you look at guys like Dropbox and even this MediaFire, is it possible, you know, Google's MO is to drive the cost of storage close to free.
Yeah.
So they can, because their business is something else. And, you know, if you look at somebody like Dropbox, when their business is storage, you know, when you have an Amazon S3 price cut like they did, they have to make a decision to either keep the prices the same and pass that savings along, or just finally take more profits. And so that's kind of what I'm wrestling with, is can a storage-only company make it? In the consumer space, in the enterprise space, sure, you know, certainly. But in the consumer, yeah, in the consumer space where it's so competitive and you got free players, and, you know, close to free, is it possible? You know, it's surprising to me that Amazon isn't more aggressive in some sort of cloud storage. I mean, they've got, you know, their cloud photos and cloud music. But mm-hmm. you know, they're like Google, where they've got the infrastructure in place. I'm surprised they've just not come out and said, look, we're giving every Amazon user 1 terabyte cloud drive for free, or free with a Prime membership.
You can sort of imagine that Amazon's got that ready to go whenever the market requires them to have something like that. You know, they probably have the technology built and they could just drop it whenever they need to.
Well, and I, you know, there's the rumor of the phone. You know, they got the Fire TV, they've got the Kindle yeah. Fire tablets, and of course they don't have a computer, but who knows, that could not be far off. When I say computer, I mean a traditional laptop or desktop. Mm-hmm. And they've got the infrastructure in place to offer something like that. I mean, again, you know, they own Dropbox is on Amazon servers. Amazon, I could, you know, I think they could be 5 gigs for free. I could easily see them giving you a terabyte with a Prime membership and saying, look, you know, all your photos with us. We have a syncing client. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, Amazon is a company that very much interests me. I don't. Their hardware, it seems, is always a little suspect in the beginning. I've not heard great things about Fire TV after it looking really nice in the beginning. I've not read a single positive review mm-hmm. about it, but we didn't read anything about the original Kindle Fires that was positive either. And over time, kind of each one has gotten better and better and better. I don't think it's near the iPad yet, but Amazon's a company to watch because they're dangerous because they don't seem to have to make money off anything.
Yeah, they get to live in fantasy land, unfortunately. Well, I don't know about unfortunately. I mean, it's good for us, but it's interesting. You know, they can just do those things with overwhelming force whenever they need to. And I think the thing that's kind of interesting with the Kindle Fire to me is that it started off like this really cheap alternative to the iPad that looked about as good, and it turned out not to be as good. And as it started to get closer to the iPad, it had to get more expensive and bigger as well. And I kind of feel that's also my concern about Chromebooks, is that Chromebooks came in, you know, really cheap laptops to start with, and they weren't actually that good. I mean, I've got one and it's not that good. But it seems that Chromebooks are definitely getting better, but as they're getting better, they're also getting more expensive. You know, so suddenly Chromebooks are, instead of £190, are now £250 to £280, and then there's a few that are tipping over £300, and so on and so on. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not Amazon can make their things better and keep their prices at the same level, you know, regardless of the fantasy money that they get to play with now and again.
Well, and another the article I remember reading about their Kindle Fire HD is their screen is actually technically better than the iPad, from what I've read. Mm-hmm. But it's because they buy it, they don't need the yield that Apple does, where Apple has to do things from a manufacturing standpoint in such mass that they can't do what Amazon does from a screen technology. And as Amazon gets more, you know, if they get more market share, those are the kind of decisions they have to make. And they certainly don't have the manufacturing capability, you know, from a capacity standpoint, and probably nor the expertise of Apple.
Well, in some ways, that's the reason why the Amazon products don't make it out of the US very quickly. It's because if they did just say, well, hey, let's sell us the entire world, and the entire world showed up at their door to buy it, they literally couldn't make enough. And it would be a very embarrassing situation for them to be in. And you're right that Apple has to be pretty conservative about the parts and the technologies that it uses, because it has to be able to get 50 million of them every 3 months that work and work well in order to satisfy the demand that Apple just basically lives at now. So it's a different world for Apple, most definitely.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see. Yeah, mm-hmm. I thought about getting a Fire TV, but just not heard great reviews. So I'll hang off and stick with my Rokus for now.
Yes, indeed. So you completely switched over from Apple TV?
No Apple TVs. I'm sure I'll buy one. Now, let me preface this. I have all Rokus and really love them, but I'm sure when Apple releases something new, I will probably buy it and mm-hmm. test it. One of the reasons I sold my Apple TVs instead of just hanging on to them is I figured the value would get dramatically worse when the new one came out. Because mm-hmm. the hardware they're using is so really long in the tooth. It's not changed yes. much since that original Black Puck was released, other than like a 1080p upgrade. And, mm-hmm. and so I'm sure whatever new thing they have is, from a software perspective, I'm probably take advantage of a new hardware. I hope. So I'll pick one up then. If I like it, maybe I'll switch back to that.
Yeah. Well, we wait with interest. WWDC, they've announced it, and we don't know what's coming. Although a lot of rumors about bigger iPhones floating about today. Don't know if you saw some of those molds that were supposed to be. They were claimed to be the molds for the new 5.7-inch iPhone and 4.7 and 5.1 or 5.2. Hard to tell what it looks like from a mold, but I promise you, if Apple ships one of those things, I'm going to queue up for it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting if they have more than one. I'll have to make that decision. But if they had just one, and it was bigger, and maybe like the 5S hung around, because I have a 5. Mm-hmm. If the 5S hung around, I'd probably have to go bigger. I like the size it is now, but I'm also want the fastest available.
Yeah, I'm not super happy with the iPhone 5. I think it's possibly apart from the performance of it and the camera, which are great and I love, it's kind of been my least favorite iPhone yet. And partly it's because I think the 3.5-inch screen was actually, I think, pretty perfect. And given that Apple made a decision to go beyond that size, they kind of did it in, I think, quite a half-hearted way where, how can I explain this? It was bigger enough that you lost the benefits of having it so hand-holdable as a 3.5-inch screen, but it didn't go bigger enough that you got any additional benefits. And so it was kind of additional size and space for basically not much actual benefit, And if they had gone bigger, I think you would have seen a bigger change in what you could do with the phone. Whereas what we got was it's a bigger phone, but you basically use it exactly the same way as a smaller phone. I thought it was a little bit conservative.
Yeah, and I know this is dumb, but like I saw a screenshot of a bigger iPhone, and it didn't have any more room on the home screen for app icons. And I thought, mm-hmm. how disappointing would that be if we get a 5-inch iPhone, and then like they just make the app icons bigger? Okay, let me have more on the screen, and you try to start reimagining workflows and. Not just let me see text bigger, but let's try to do more with the apps.
The tricky thing for Apple is that they've got this hard line between the phone and the tablet. And the tablet UI is very different from the phone UI. And the question is, at what point does something become a phone versus a tablet? And that's what I think is kind of an interesting and tricky line for them to cross. If I was betting, I would guess that iOS 8 will probably do something to blur that line. Here's one unified approach to design or whatever that means that whether you're on a phone or whether you're on a, phablet, let's say, or a tablet, there's one unified design language across them all. Because at the moment, you obviously design an iPhone app quite differently from the way you design an iPad app. And I think it would probably be good in general if Apple could make that happen because... I think, I don't know if you've noticed this, but I've started to sort of notice a trend of apps only coming out for the iPad or the iPhone, but not both. So like Dropbox Carousel, for example, comes out as only an iPhone app. And then Lightroom Mobile comes out as only an iPad app. I'm thinking, well, I'm sure Apple would rather that all those things came out for both at once. And if they had some way to unify that, that would make a ton of sense to me. So fingers crossed for iOS 8.
Good problems to have.
Yes, indeed.
Before we move on with our topic for this week, let's thank our sponsor for this week's episode. the fine folks at Jamp Software. They provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in education organizations. This includes Macs, iPads, iPhones, and even Apple TVs. Now with Casper Focus, they have placed these great technologies in the hands of teachers who work with students every day. So Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV assigned to the class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. Learn what else you can do with Casper Focus at jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. We'll have a link to them in the show notes at outofschool.net. So if you're looking for an MDM provider, do us a favor, at least take a look at Jamp, do a demo, and let them know that that we sent you. So we want to thank them for sponsoring the show this week.
Yes, indeed. Good stuff. So, Bradley, what's your topic for tonight? This is part 10 of the deployment series. How far have we got?
Yeah, we're at part 10, and so we are like almost two-thirds of the way done. It's hard to believe.
Yeah, I'm sure there's more to talk about that we've forgotten, but we'll get there.
So tonight it's pupil safety. From we have kind of two breakpoints in there. One is digital safety, and then the other one is actually personal safety. So we'll start with digital safety. So the first thing you want to think about is how you're going to protect your devices from content when they're on site. And so depending on what kind of environment you have now, you may not have a big content filtering infrastructure. Now, I think anybody that listens to this show knows that you and I are both of the mindset to be reactive to blocking and not be proactive and try to in your filtering, try to check every box and try to block everything and be a dictator. I know it's always difficult, like if someone gets a hold of something, gets into something, and then the headmaster brings you, the computer say, look what we got into. Why isn't this blocked? I know that's difficult and a balance you have to find. But to me, no filtering is perfect. And so you're either going to have situations where it lets in some things that maybe be questionable from time to time, or it's proactive about blocking things that are legitimate. And so I think you have the mindset of let's try to let people have more free access to the internet.
Absolutely. I think the first line of our acceptable use policy is that the school considers the internet to be a valuable educational resource, and all of our policies are biased towards its use. So it's net positive at the start. And then obviously there's things that are unacceptable in school. And I think what's important is that you have to clearly explain what is unacceptable and what's not. And then once you've made a clear definition, then you can have a conversation about, is that within our policy or not? And not always, that conversation is not always just like at the managerial level, but that conversation can be had with the students themselves because they've seen the acceptable use policy. And I can say to somebody, look, that game you've installed, how do you think that fits into our acceptable use policy? Do you think it's okay to have a game that involves killing other people as part of the school situation? Maybe yes, maybe no. And let's talk about it. And in what sense would it be okay? And in what sense wouldn't it be? And I've had some great conversations about that with pupils recently, where we've looked at some games that kids have downloaded and have said, well, this one's clearly just about shooting humans. Are we okay with that kind of game? And, the answer is probably, probably not. That's not okay. Right. And then we look at another game, is this okay? Well, it's very cartoony. And then we start to have conversations about content and what's appropriate and what's not, and what the effect of accessing that content might be on the pupils themselves or on people who are watching it being accessed and so on. So it opens up a lot of conversations and a lot of learning that a simple block just never allows to happen in the school.
I look at the blocks like the bumpers at the bowling alley. Mm-hmm. And you can put them up and you can keep kids out of the gutter when they're bowling, but that's not life. And this kind of goes back to a discussion about digital safety and digital responsibility. When the kids leave your school and they either go to college or they get an apartment or whatever, and even at home, they likely have open access to the internet. And so, do we shelter them in our schools and not have these conversations about knowing what content's appropriate? To me, if a student brought in a dirty magazine, is that okay? Well, no. I mean, but then do we ban paper, or do we check backpacks at the door to make sure that there are no dirty magazines? No, we discipline the student. Just as if someone is searching out content that's inappropriate and happens to find something that's not blocked, we discipline the student. We don't then go crazy on the filtering and then legitimately block useful educational resources. No, we deal with this. We deal with the problem. Just it's like the old thing I've said many times. If we have a fight at recess, we don't cancel recess. We deal with the problem.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the way I've always looked at this is in relationship to what's called safety culture. In industries where there's a risk of accidents or death as part of the normal operation of the business. So, for example, aviation, right, where if you fly the plane incorrectly or recklessly, then you could crash and kill people. Or nuclear power plants where if you run the thing wrong, you're going to blow up and contaminate the entire area. And there's lots to be said about safety culture, but one of the things is that, or one of the kind of evolutions of safety culture over the last 50 years has been the idea that accidents will happen, right? But the reasons, years and years ago, that it was always like the person who was driving the train that was blamed for the crash, right? Driver error, pilot error, human error is always the thing that is easy to blame, usually because the people who may have committed those errors are probably dead, right? The guy who crashed the train is probably dead, so it's easy to blame him. But more recent thinking around about safety culture has led people to realize that there are many factors that lead up to an accident happening, and it's not just the person who did the thing at the end that caused the accident to happen. There are many factors leading up to that and building up to it. And I like to think about e-safety in kind of the same way, that what's most important is that you learn from when something goes wrong. And I think the key thing is that in almost all circumstances, some kind of inappropriate access to the internet is not a life or death situation. In very rare cases, it sadly is, and we have to be aware of that. But most of the time, if something comes up in Google image search that isn't suitable for school, nobody will die, right? So the next thing is, can we learn from that situation? A, is that appropriate or not? We can discuss that depending on what the content is. B, how can we stop that happening again? Right? And that's the mature and modern way to look at, for example, a train that runs through a red light. Okay? One way the driver could deal with that is they could pretend it never happened and they could cover up and nobody would ever learn anything about improving railway safety. The other way that could happen is that could be reported, and then the whole organization, not just the driver, but the training organization, the signal designers, the track designers, the shift schedulers, engineers, trackside maintenance, everybody can learn from the reasons why that happened. And with any kind of e-safety incident, I think one of the key things is for everybody to be able to learn from what happened. Because sometimes e-safety incidents are provoked by the teacher, not by the pupil. Right? It's not always the case that it's just dirty wee boys looking up dirty pictures on the internet. But it can be very generally innocent things that just the terminology that was used can lead to something coming up that shouldn't come up. And teachers are perhaps not always au fait with all the double entendres that can be used in every culture in the world. And short of checking your entire lesson plan through the Urban Dictionary before you say any words, then I don't know how you're going to prevent that from happening. But the learning process is the important thing. So the way we deal with it at our school, of course we filter the web, but what we also say is, if something comes up that's inappropriate and you genuinely weren't searching for it, you should tell a teacher straight away, we'll talk about it, and that's the incident over, right? Once we've all learned from what happened there. Whereas if we find out that you've been routinely searching for inappropriate material in a kind of covert way, and we find this out through logs and inspections and things like that, then that's going to become a disciplinary matter. So that's kind of how we deal with that. And it's influenced by safety culture theory, which is a whole body of work and learning and documentation. But I think it's a very, very important way to work, that just blocking those things, nobody learns, and it doesn't actually help people's performance either. Sorry, that was a bit of a rant.
I think that last part was so true. It doesn't help them. And I think it's a cultural shift, and as much as anything, it's a good discussion point, and So, you know, I guess ultimately, how do we do this? If we do need to filter, we obviously need to filter some stuff. So how do we do it? We do it two ways, actually three. We have the content filtering service on our firewall. Probably most firewalls or security appliances have those. We also have Open DNS Enterprise. It's now called Umbrella, but we also have their kind of on-site networking security plan. Blocks things at the DNS level. And then we also use Arrowhive's application visibility and control. And that's less of a filtering as much as it is, you know, kind of controlling applications. Of course, it's funny. That's actually getting trickier. Well, let me say this. Like, they have had the ability to say, okay, block Facebook games but allow Facebook. But as Facebook is moving to all to HTTPS traffic, that is getting not possible.
Yes, I think this is another interesting conversation, Bradley, is the question of for how long is this even going to be possible, right? Because essentially what you're doing with content filtering is you're doing a man-in-the-middle attack. Literally, you're standing in the middle of what should otherwise be a secure connection to some remote server, and you're decrypting the traffic and then re-encrypting it and checking it on the way. And I think, you know, a lot of the summer revelations about security last year have led a lot of services to think about going to much more encryption and more of the time. I know Tim Bray, when he was at Google, was a big proponent of just HTTPS by default everywhere. And I think, you know, the difficulty of doing that for any kind of scale, you know, even for a small school, the cost involved in building a proxy server that can decrypt and re-encrypt without a major hit on the performance of your network is going to be pretty high. And if you're a school of 2,000 people plus maybe 200 or 300 staff, I don't know how you're going to build a box that can do that, far less do it at a local authority level. It's going to be enormous cost if people insist on being able to do that.
Well, and then you even think just like, I don't know, 15 years from now, are we even in the business of deploying networks in our school, or are we just deploying devices that have LTE connections that are unlimited? Is there some sort of like new business model where we, you know, buy buckets of data from AT&T or, you know, whoever your carrier is? Like, you know, and it's like, even then at that point, you certainly can't do anything on your local network.
Yeah. What you said there, Bradley, is often considered by people to be a completely insane question. Like, there's no way that will ever be affordable. But I think that day is absolutely coming where that is the model that we use, particularly, you know, people like you and I who are a little bit more forward thinking in terms of how much we outsource of our networking. I absolutely believe that day is coming that we'll buy LTE devices. In fact, I believe the day is coming where every device will just have LTE and you won't be able to buy Wi-Fi only. And then there will be mechanisms to buy corporate accounts for data and stuff like that. I mean, there already are. They're just cost prohibitive at the moment. But, you know, hard drives were cost prohibitive at one time as well. And they're not anymore. So, yeah, that's the question. And I think one of the key things is that the interesting thing with iOS 7 is that iOS 7 brought in this idea of a content filter running right on the device itself. Have you tried that out?
Yes, and I was initially very excited about it, but it's from what I've seen so far, it's completely overkill, and there's no way to customize it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, just in case people are unfamiliar with what this is a restriction you can apply through a configuration profile that basically turns on a web filter on the device, which means that, you know, Bradley and I have been talking about doing filtering at the network level, so we have a filtered network. But what this does is actually does filtering on the device, which means that whatever network the device moves on to, and obviously as being a mobile device, there are multiple networks that every device will move on to, the filtering will still apply. So what Apple's done in iOS 7 is they basically put in a filter at the right architectural level, which is low in the networking code on iOS that applies to Safari, any embedded web view in any app, and any alternative browser that you install. And you're right, Bradley, the problem is that although it's architected very well and it's very secure, the actual process of content filtering is very rudimentary right now, shall we say. It's highly overzealous when it does filter, And often, you know, essentially, it's barely better than just turning off Safari overall. But it does have this nice impact of touching the other uses of the WebKit layer in iOS as well. Because a lot of schools, I don't know if you had this issue, Bradley, but a lot of schools have had a problem with any app that can bring up a web view had to be banned because that was free access to the web. And
it's a lot of apps to ban.
Yep. Yeah, well, there's basically every app at some level at this point. And I think the other thing I've seen some people do is turn off Safari with a configuration profile and then install some kind of third-party browser that talks to filtering service. I'm not sure I can remember the names of any of them. I think K9 was one at one time. And usually these were just like terrible clones of Safari using UI WebView and some, you know, glue to have a URL bar and stuff like that in the middle.
Well, and you wonder, of course, you just hope that Apple's got their, because the idea of doing it through a configuration profile is awesome. Mm-hmm. And that kind of, you know, that kind of leads into discussion about content filtering offsite, you know, because that's something parents are certainly going to be asking about. And sadly, there's not, you know, for iOS, there's not a great like turnkey solution other than OpenDNS Umbrella, which that's not a, it's not something that like regular people pay for their house. That's a enterprise grade tool. Again, like we mentioned, the iOS filter is overkill at this point. But I wonder if a lot of problems would be solved with this one customization, only block adult oriented content.
Mm.
You know, just basically, you know, just block pornography. Like if you could just say block all forms of pornography. Of course, like our Sonic Wall has a bikini and lingerie checkbox on top of nudity. So you could have those too. Like you wonder how many problems are ultimately solved by that one simple modification. Because that the conversations I have are, I'm not saying that girls can't get into trouble, but they're generally conversations with mothers of young boys.
Mm-hmm.
And I get it. Like I was a teenager once. I get mm-hmm. it. And those are questions like I will want answered when my sons are teenagers. My sons are 9 months and 3.5, so they're much more concerned about. Funny story is my son really wants to play Grand Theft Auto on my iPad. But obviously, it's just there needs to be a Grand Theft Auto without the killing. Yeah, that's a side note. But you know, this is a difficult problem for parents to wrap their head around. You know, you can certainly mm-hmm. recommend like the OpenDNS Family Shield, where you change your DNS settings in your router. But that's so easily spoofed by anyone who Googles how to bypass OpenDNS Family Shield.
Yeah, but see, at some level with that, you know, how secure does one have to make it? I mean, it really is a balancing act here because, you know, at some level, if somebody Googles that and they reset their DNS settings, then that's an explicit action which is designed to circumvent a security protocol, right? It's not clear to me that... I mean, obviously, you know, one could make a case that anything is somebody's responsibility, but, you know, when an individual takes a decision to work around security that has been provided, then, you know, at some level, that's on them rather than on you. I'm not saying we shouldn't do our best to make our things non-circumventable, but at the end of the day, that's a choice that somebody's made. The trick would be, I think, you know, more that you could detect it, rather than that you could completely prevent it. And I think one of the interesting things about the iOS 7 web filter is that it also disables private browsing mode and also disables clearing the web history. And those two things I think are really interesting. And if I could actually have those two features without the web filter, I think I would rather have that so that I can always go and inspect the web history and that web history can't be circumvented by private browsing mode. And even if it didn't have the filter, if I could just turn on those two features, I think I would be in good shape because then we can use our inspection procedures to pick up any, you know, willful access to inappropriate material. Because if the user can't clear their browser history, then that's going to be useful.
Yeah, and I imagine this is like one of those, I had a blog that went up today about, you know, hanging fruit for Apple and education. This is probably something mm-hmm. that should be there is, you know, kind of solve this issue, you know, on the device through some sort of like restriction, you know, Again, it could be a restriction, a checkbox, limit adult content. So you're, but you're right, though. It's a balancing act on how secure do you make it. It's just like anything else. You know, if you have a liquor cabinet, you know, how big is your lock? You know, at some point, if your kid's trying to get in there at all, that's an issue you must deal with. Do you do the education, or do you put more locks on it?
What you do is you put an internet-connected vibration sensor in your liquor cabinet. And then your phone buzzes every time the kids are in there.
yes. Motion sensor. So,
but here's the overall point, though, Bradley, is that there are already unfiltered networks in your school. And in your case, they're called AT&T and Verizon. Over here, they're called 3 and O2 and Vodafone and whatever. But the advent of mobile networking just means that at some level, what you're doing is you're covering yourself for liability rather than really guaranteeing anything. Because we could lock down our networks to the nth degree. I mean, we can do that. We know how to do it. It's not hard to do. But what are we really achieving with that? Are we achieving a marked increase in pupil safety? Or are we just, you know, having something good to say to the jury when that day comes? Because I think at some level, you know, the more secure you make your network, the more you push people off onto some other network that is completely insecure and unfiltered. And I know for a fact that pupils in our school are carrying iPhones. And I know for a fact that many of them have data plans. And I know for a fact that most of them probably know how to turn on personal hotspot. And once that happens, what can I do, right? How can I stop this from happening? Am I going to, you know, build a Faraday cage around the building and, you know, only let them use our network? I mean, this is getting into spy territory, really. And it's hard to see, absent some kind of education plan, how you can get people to make better decisions. You can't technologically lock this out. I mean, the ship has sailed. So what are we going to do? It's got to be about education. It's not because I think that technical blocks can't be made, because they can be made, but they're not. The world's just saturated with communication now, and turning it all off is just not practical. You have to go full North Korea if you want to achieve that kind of thing. And some institutions do that, but I just don't think that's really, it's not really solving the problem. It's just pushing it off your plate.
Yeah, it's pushing it to their next school, their college, or you're setting it up for disaster. It's kind of like people that are sheltered their whole life and are exposed to, you know, any sort of disease. Well, they're eventually going to be around disease, and so then they have no immunity. So, yeah. You know, for me, I think this kind of thing is as much about parent communication as it is about student communication. And, mm-hmm. and these are where you need to have an open dialogue with your parents about this and talk to them about it and say, mm-hmm. look, we don't have all the answers. New social networks are cropping up overnight where your kids can be communicating with other kids, be opportunity for bullying, inappropriate conversations. And I think you just, you know, no parent's ever going to be an expert. You're never going to be an expert. But the conversation is very valuable, and I think your parents appreciate your effort to keep them informed because they know you can't block everything. And if a kid wants to get in trouble, they're going to get in trouble.
Yeah. I mean, at some level, teenagers don't want to be safe. You know, I mean, isn't that one of the hallmarks of adolescence is, you know, insane risk-taking? I'm not saying that we should encourage that or we should just enable that willy-nilly. But I am saying that it's going to happen, right? And I was reading recently, there's an article, not an article, a report by the Ofcom communications regulator in the UK, and they were talking about pupils and e-safety. And one of the things that came out of that report was that the child's school is, I think, either number one or number two place that parents look to for advice about e-safety. And I think, you know, I know we have done as good a job as we can, but I know we can do a better job on that for our parents as well. I hadn't realized that parents maybe thought so highly of the school in that aspect, but it's certainly something that we're a conversation that we're going to keep going with, because you're right. You know, everything's evolving into a chat app. I mean, this is, I did a thing with a class where we were looking at ways to kind of organize yourself, and I had them sign up for Wunderlist. So that we could look at how you would maybe use a shared to-do list. And within 30 seconds of that happening and everybody getting onto a shared to-do list, the to-do list was being used as a chat application. And it was just insane. Well, what happened was that we found out later that every time you get a to-do list sent to you, you also get an email sent to you. So by the end of this chat session, everybody had like 1,000 emails to delete. So that was their lunch break, was just spending an hour deleting all the emails off their iPad.
Yeah, it's like, can we just delete all? Let's just set up a new email. No, you think about the Carousel app from Dropbox has chat in it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, everything is all about, it's just... I kind of liken it to one of the things we're dealing with right now is my oldest son has eczema on his like back of his legs and his bottom. It cropped up out of nowhere. Apparently, eczema is really common in kids under 10. Never was when I was a kid. I guess it's like peanut butter allergies, that it's the steroids in the chicken or something. But so we've gone to the pediatrician multiple times, and he says a lot of it's due to seasonal allergies, which the pollen in Chattanooga is. Like normal, one day was, normal was like 100, okay? One day we had 700. So, I mean, it's like my grill is yellow some days. It's, the pollen is so bad. And so, is it totally my doctor's responsibility to fix my son, to fix his skin? Well, in some way, that's what we're paying him for. But also, like, we're his parents. And that's like our role. So we start researching, like, ways to treat it and... we've introduced coconut oil into his diet at the recommendation of a friend of mine. And, those things seem to be helping. And so it's like the doctor isn't like, it's not like that I'm, as a parent, mindless about my son's health and well-being. The doctor is certainly the expert, and we certainly trust our doctor to the, 100%. But we also research stuff online, and because with a lot of things, like different medicines work on different kids. And so we learn things to try, things he can eat or different kind of lotions to try. And because, even though he's the expert, I'm still the parent. And it's really the same thing. Even though we're like, we may be the tech experts, you're still the parent, and it's still your kid's behavior. Just because it's, it's like if they're, playing kickball at home and they fight, is that the school's fault because they also play kickball at school? Well, no, they're just kids being kids and they get in a fight. And if the kids get in trouble on technology at home, well, just it's not the school's responsibility to maintain, your son or daughter's technology habits. I mean, they still have to take personal responsibility there. I don't know if that analogy makes sense, but it did to me.
It does. I mean, and there is, one of the defining aspects of childhood is that, a child does not have the ability to exercise all the responsibilities of adulthood for themselves. That's why parents are given that kind of power over children in our society. And I think it's important not to lose sight of that, both, when the school acts in the position of the parent or the parent acts as the parent themselves. In some ways, our society has kind of gotten away from the idea that children should do what they're told. And quite often it's, that we talk about being child-centered all the time, as if sometimes that can be taken too far, where, the child just gets whatever they want. And it's important to recognize that the school has to act in a certain authoritative way, and the parents have to act that way too. And the two have to be in sync. And I think you're absolutely right that parent communication is both vital and necessary, because quite often what I find is that parents don't really understand what they've already done. And it's kind of interesting to me that I've had conversations in the past where parents who have provided their children with Xbox, with an Xbox Live connection and a TV in their own bedroom and a laptop, are suddenly concerned about what might happen if the school gives them an iPad. And they've got access to all this stuff already. Or they've given the kids a smartphone. I say, well, you've given your kids a smartphone. You've already just put them on a completely unfiltered network with no supervision whatsoever. And I'm proposing to give them a computer on a filtered network with supervision from adults. And somehow that's more of a risk. And suddenly it's like, oh, hang on, should we maybe take that off them or whatever, So it's important to make people aware of what they've done, the situation they've already created, before you start to bring in the conversation about, well, we want to do this iPad thing as well. Because I'm certain for probably most of our children that their school iPad is the best secured, best supervised computer in their entire lives, bar none. And there's some parents who are very proactive about their children's internet use, typically parents of younger children, I might add. But often I've seen with parents of teenagers that, you know, they never look at anything they do. You know, they never supervise anything. And in some cases, you know, you kind of hear the kids crying out for a little bit more supervision and boundaries in these things. And they would like some guidance on what's suitable and what's not, and how long is suitable and how long is not. But just laying down the law with a technological lock, I don't think is the way to do it.
Yeah. And I think that's a great place to end that kind of that part of the conversation, because this problem is just going to, in some ways, get worse, but it's also going to evolve. Mm-hmm. And we hope the technology evolves, but at the end of the day, it's about responsibility.
It is. And it's also about making people aware, because at some level, you know, there are some profoundly evil things on the internet. Let's not kid on about that. And there are some profoundly evil people on the internet. But quite often what I find is that kids aren't really that evil, right? And they genuinely just don't realize what is possible. And they often stumble into it through ignorance than through willfulness. And I think a lot of the conversation about filtering and blocking is often about an assumption of, you know, bad faith on the part of the pupils. Whereas in fact, more often than not, it's just kind of naivety or innocence rather than actual wrongdoing on their part as well. I want to talk about a couple of other things, Bradley, just to wrap up this whole question of safety. The first one is personal safety, in terms of your actual personal physical safety when you do a one-to-one iPad program. And it's a question that comes up a lot. You know, I've gone to a lot of schools and I've done parents' evenings and Q&A sessions and so on. And one of the questions that comes up a lot, particularly for secondary school, where the proposal is that the kids get to take the iPad home, is, well, won't our kids just be mugged in the high street for their iPad? And I think it's a fair question. And I think it's something that people are right to be concerned about. One of the ways that we looked at that when we first went into iPads was we asked ourselves, well, what proportion of our pupils actually travel home independently? And actually, in the case of our school, because we take pupils from quite a wide area, we found that it was actually a very low proportion of our pupils walked or got buses to school versus coming in some kind of private transport. But one of the things we did do was we actually got the data on that. We didn't just go, well, it's probably about half or whatever. We actually counted it up and we said, well, we know these people come in a car, these people come on the bus, these people get a private taxi, these people come on the school bus, whatever, whatever. And we figured out that it was, I forget the exact number, but I think it was about 80% of our kids came in some kind of safe private transport. So we're looking at a small proportion anyway, and then you say, well, how many of those are actually going to take their iPad home with them anyway? Well, it's only, you know, half of that group, so you're talking about, you know, maybe, what would that be, like 10% of the whole school who might be at risk of being mugged. And for every school, that's different. Again, you know, the theme of this whole series is that for your school, their numbers might be different. And if your school is actually 90% walk home from school through the town, then you may want to consider this as more of an issue or whatever. So the other question is, what's the existing risk? And I think, you know, the more we look at that, the more I think, well, most secondary pupils are probably a good bet for some kind of technology anyway. If you're going to mug somebody, you know, why not mug just anybody who's got headphones on, because they've probably got a smartphone at the end of that wire? So are we really making them more at risk? And how well known is your program going to get? I mean, it's true that quite often, you know, the first school in an area to go iPad gets a lot of publicity, but the second and third schools maybe don't get so much. And eventually, I think this problem, you know, either everybody's going to be at risk or nobody's going to be at risk, because eventually this will become a kind of normal thing for a lot of kids to be carrying this kind of technology, which doesn't mean they're not at risk, but it means that your individual pupil may be at lower risk than if they were the only person in the whole area who had an iPad with them. So the question is, how do you make it any worse than it already is? And do you? Look at the crime statistics. I mean, if you have already got that kind of number in front of you, you probably know you've already got a problem. I mean, I've worked with some schools where they have such a crime problem that the pupils are actually allowed to come to school in plain clothes and then change into school uniform at school and then change back for going home. because it's such a risk for them to walk through their local area with their school uniform on. Never mind, that's not a school that's one-to-one iPad at all. It's just a school that is known to be quite a well-off school in a slightly troubled area, and the pupils are considered to be a little bit at risk in that area because of the school uniform that they wear. So it's all something to bear in mind. One of the really good ways of things about iOS 7 is that with activation lock, it's kind of becoming a bit more known now that it's harder to, or a bit more pointless to steal an iOS device than before. And also, if you can do something that sort of marks, you know, if you can get your iPads engraved or something as property of our school, then that can, you can also, when you do get that publicity, make that fact known as part of the story. So, you know, school X just got all these iPads. They've all been branded with the school's logo on the back and a case, and try and make sure that gets into the news story so that anybody who's reading and planning some kind of heist or attack will find out that the devices that they steal will be marked as property of the school. So that's kind of a tip there.
You know, one thing to keep in mind on that point is if you, I know like Apple typically doesn't do buybacks if they've been asset tagged. I don't know how that applies to engraving, but I know like if you have those like asset tags that a lot of big businesses use, Apple will not buy devices mm-hmm. back. But I don't know. I don't think that I doubt that applies to engraving though.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Not sure.
But yeah, it's the activation lock, I think, was really, really important. That is very, very difficult to get around. You've basically got to be able to prove that you're the right person that on that device.
There was a case in the UK not so long ago where a woman had bought an iPad and upgraded to iOS 7, and then she died. And her children, who had inherited her iPad, were up in arms because Apple wouldn't undo the activation lock so the kids could use their deceased mother's iPad. And they even had things like, they had like a court warrant showing that the woman had died, and they had the death certificate and, you know, all the documents that showed that they were the executors of her estate and all this stuff. And so, and still the answer was, sorry, no, no. So I think the tip is put your passwords in your will.
Yeah, I've got it like a, well, one thing I do too is like anything that I have two-factor authentication on, my wife's phone number is always the backup. But yeah, I have like a document. Well, my wife knows my 1Password password, and then everything is in there on my passwords. And then also like with my wills and stuff are my like recovery keys and stuff. Those are locked up tight.
Okay. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, it's like crazy to think about stuff like that. Like, you know, I mean, as our worlds become more digital, I mean, you can imagine like if you're, I don't know, your thermostat's Wi-Fi enabled and your wife doesn't know the passcode to get into the thermostat.
Mm-hmm. You know. All of these things. I mean, digital estate planning is going to be a thing. And if I was in law school right now, I would think about specializing in that for the next 50 years. Last thing I want to mention, Bradley, is we've talked about e-safety and physical safety, but also want to talk about, you know, the famous health and safety in the UK is a particular concern for some people in terms of postural issues and eye strain and repetitive strain injuries and so on in schools with the use of computers. And in order to prepare for this show, I went to the Health and Safety Executive's website, which is, it's like OSHA in the US, I think, is the equivalent. And they have this document called Display Screen Regulations, which is kind of their advice on how to work with display screens. And the document that I found was last published in 2003, so doesn't exactly have a lot of direct advice about tablet computers. But the general principles are kind of the same. You know, all the things we know about RSI and everything are still apply. But if you think about, you know, the world that we've come from, where the computer's fixed position on the desk and the pupil sits down at the computer and never moves for the whole duration of their use, and then they get up and go away, right? That's simply not the way the world works with an iPad in the classroom. The iPad classroom is much more dynamic, much more varied, and much more changeable than the traditional computer lab, because the computers themselves aren't fixed either. And I remember hearing a talk, I think it was from people who worked at Intel on the Classmate PC, you know, Intel's little kind of robust netbook that they used to sell. And they had this phrase which I thought was really useful. It's kind of stuck with me all this time. They called it micromobility. And what they meant by that was the ability of this computer, because the classmates like an articulated screen netbook where you can turn it around and use it like a tablet. And their idea of micromobility was the concept that you could sort of move it around the desk and you could hand it to somebody and you could turn it around and you could show it and so on. And I think what I've observed over years of using iPad in school now is that the iPad classroom is a much more dynamic place to be. It's much more mobile. The children change posture much more often. They move much more often. They change activity much more often than they ever would have done with a static computer, whether that be a laptop or a desktop. Because there you're just sitting, you're working on the keyboard, and you never essentially change position because the form factor dictates that you sort of stay in that one place with the computer until you're done. Whereas if you think about what you might do in a classroom with an iPad, maybe you're shooting a movie at one point, and then you're typing for a while, and then you get up and you bring the computer to the teacher, you move around. Even just saying bring the computer to the teacher is a thing that you wouldn't even have said a few years ago. And I find that the opportunity to take breaks and to change position and to just, you know, move around a little bit is greatly increased with a much more mobile device in your hands, because you can change position as required. And often the activity requires you to change the use of the device from being something you type on to something you draw on to something you lift and use in another way over the course. So we are careful. It's something that we look at, how long are the people sitting on the computer, on the iPad at one time. And rarely, it's quite easy to achieve this in secondary because obviously you have period breaks. So, you know, kids sit for 50 minutes, they do one thing, they go away, go to another classroom, walk about for a little bit, sit there and do a different thing with it. So it's something to be aware of, but I think it's not something that to me is of great concern, and at least not in the same way as it was. Is it something that you've had people ask you about, Bradley?
No, not really at all, but I see the benefits of mobile computing. I think about like walking into our classrooms when they're not doing things that are digital. They're, if they're drawing or writing. A lot of times, you have students that are in their desk, and you have some that are on the floor, laying on their stomach writing. It's taking the where you have to be a certain place to do computing out of the question. So instead of saying you have to do computing in the computing lab or you have to do computing at your desk with your laptop, it's like, I'm just going to go sit on the beanbag in the corner and work on this movie. Or I'm going to read this, or I'm going to try to, correct my report. I'm going to go sit in the gym, or I'm going to go sit in the John, whatever you want to do.
well, indeed. And I think it's one of the things about the tablet form factor is that it becomes whatever you want to do with it. Right. So in the course of a school day, that tablet might be a keyboard to type on at one point, and then it's a camera, and then it's something to draw on, and then it's something to hold and read from. And all of those are different postures. If you think about how you would organize your body to do those different tasks, to type on it, you'd be sitting more upright. To draw on it, you'd maybe be leaning over it a little bit more. And then, obviously you're standing up, possibly even moving around when you're using it as a camera, and so on and so on. I think that's one of the interesting things about the tablet form factor is that it does not increase classroom isolation, and it doesn't increase the amount of static time that people sit at a desk. It in fact does the opposite. It encourages collaboration because you can hold up the tablet and show someone else or move closer to someone else. I mean, one of the early questions people ask me all the time was, well, how do people collaborate on the iPad? As if they were waiting for me to say some kind of, there's a magic cloud thing and everything appears on everybody else's computer. And the answer I always gave, Bradley, was just, well, if you want to collaborate on the iPad, we just move our chairs together. And we lift the iPads and we go and sit beside each other. That's how we collaborate. And it's that kind of simplicity that I think is really important to understand, because everybody has the wrong conception of what an iPad classroom looks like. Almost without fail, whenever you do a parents' evening about iPad or do a Q&A with staff about an iPad, they always say, won't this mean that the kids won't talk to each other and they'll just sit with their heads stuck in the iPad all day? And there is almost no preconception about iPad that is more wrong than the assumption that that's what will happen when you bring iPad into the classroom, because I've never seen it happen anywhere that iPad has gone into a school that I've seen.
I agree.
I'm in a kind of ranty mood tonight, I think.
Well, that's okay.
I don't know. It's been a while since we podcast, so About to get it all out of my system.
Well, it's like it's either vent to me or vent to your wife. And if she's like my wife, she would rather not hear about my day all day long when she's been cleaning up poopy diapers.
Yes, well, what happened in the bath tonight at bath time should probably go unrecorded. Say no more. Let me just put it this way. When you have a one-year-old, don't use bubble bath because it masks a lot of sins.
Yes, I have never had that happen at our house. Thankfully, that I'm sure that will come soon, though.
Yeah, George is going to love that I've just discussed this with the entire internet. What can I say? Okay, the last thing I just wanted to mention really briefly in terms of like health and safety is do think about, and I think this is one of the kind of weakest aspects of the iPad, is think about the impact of overhead lighting on screen glare. Because if you put the iPad flat on a desk and then you're sitting under a light, that can be probably the most problematic kind of postural health and safety type aspect of using the iPad. And we've actually started designing some of our classrooms to have uplighting rather than downlighting to try and soften the light sources in the ceiling so that using the iPad on the table is not as problematic as it would be if you had direct overhead lighting. That's not something you can change directly or probably immediately, but it is something to be aware of. And if I had a vote for the next iPad, I would love it to be much, much, much less reflective. It's my biggest gripe about the iPad overall, I think, actually.
It'll be be an interesting summer, I think. I think this could be a fun year.
I think it could be. It's time to see some things move around a little bit, I think. I'd like to see what people are working on. All right, shall we leave it there? Pupil safety, e-safety, health and safety, physical and personal safety. These are all things to think about. You will get asked about all of them. And it's things that you're going to want to have a specific answer to. Even if it's just we filter the network and be aware that there are unfiltered networks in the world, that may be the conversation that you have to have. And sometimes that is the most difficult conversation, is actually just explaining to parents the way the world actually is today, where it's pretty difficult to keep people off the internet and keep people off unfiltered networks. But the school has to do the best they can.
Yeah, you're right. The problem exists whether you have the conversation with them or not, or if you deploy iPads or not. The problem exists.
Yes, because even if you don't have iPads or any one-to-one program in your school, this is still a conversation you're going to have with your kids. All right. Let's knock off for tonight. Where can people find us on the web, Bradley?
I am at chambersdaily.com on the web, and I'm Bradley Chambers on Twitter.
And I'm spears.org on the web, where I just published an article about using VPP managed distribution in Casper Suite. And I'm also Fraser Spears on Twitter. We'll see you all next week.